Well, not to worry, here's Bob in your life.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, software engineer and creation speaker.
Fred, welcome to the studio. Now, I have a challenge for you today, but first, let me just announce that tomorrow is the St. Paddy's Day Parade 2010, and in Colorado, we're going to be getting signatures to put personhood on the ballot. We only have 5 days left, and this is a great place. Come on out in Denver, Fort Collins, or Colorado Springs to the St. Paddy's Day Parade. You could help get signatures. So our website, kgov.com, you can get details. I'll be there, Lord willing. I look forward to seeing you. Now, Fred, here's my challenge to you.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
I know that you're a creation kind of guy.
I am.
And so I have an edition of Creation Magazine that you don't have. And so I'd like to just highlight some of the articles in here and get your off-the-cuff take on what's being presented. Is that all right?
This sounds really good.
Sounds fun.
And I highly recommend people go to creation.com and get this magazine. I think it's the best magazine.
Yeah, it's really great. Okay, so first off, a horse is a horse. Now, Fred, creation.com and their magazine, full color, beautiful magazine, they have a photo of the world's largest horse and the world's smallest horse. They live in the USA, and the smallest horse is called Thumbelina. The largest horse is called Radar. Now, I want to describe to you the difference in size and weight of these two horses, all right? Now, the largest happens to be a male, and the smallest happens to be a female. But still, the audience will get the point. The largest weighs 2,400 pounds.
2,400 pounds, okay.
The smallest weighs 65 pounds.
65, so that's quite a difference.
That's quite a difference. And in height, the world's tallest living horse is 6.5 feet tall. And the shortest horse, Thumbelina, is 17 inches.
17 inches?
That's
wow.
1 foot and 5 inches.
And that's a full-grown adult, right? The 17-inch one.
That's right.
Both.
Both are full-grown adults. And so what I want to know from you is, does this show evolution?
Well, if we found their bones in the fossil record and we found a bunch of small horse bones,
yeah,
and then later on we found really big horse bones, I think that shows the small horse turned into a big horse over millions and millions of years.
That's what they would say, right? They'd say, look, we have in this layer, we have these small bones, horse bones. In this layer, we have bones of a large horse. So the one must have evolved into the other. The reality is they both live contemporaneously.
That's right.
For public school teachers tuning in right now, that means at the same time. And they're both same species. They're a horse. And Fred, they could interbreed. I mean, you might want to use artificial insemination. But if you bred these two, what would you get? A raccoon?
I'm betting you'd get a horse.
You'd get a horse. That's because they're both horses.
Anybody wants to take that bet, I'll give you like 1,000 to 1 odds.
1,000 to 1 odds. And so we have a horse is a horse, of course, of course.
Well, it's amazing because evolutionists, they tried to create some sort of horse evolution in the textbooks. And the only place that really exists is in the textbooks. Because you look at some of the things they say that it evolved from, and then the rib count changes over time.
There's rib count goes up and down, the number of toes. And in South America, the fossils appear in one order. In North America, they appear in a different order. So it's just make-believe, and it's so juvenile, it's so superficial to say, oh, look, the small one evolved into the big one.
That's right. And I can't remember his name, but there's an evolutionist scientist, I think it's Miles Eldridge, and he's the one who said that the only place you find horse evolution is in the textbooks.
And he's an evolutionist.
That's right. So he was criticizing the, you know, this idea of the textbooks pushing this false idea based really completely speculative, wild imagination.
Yeah.
Type evidence.
All right. Next, we have a letter to the editor in the Creation Magazine. By the way, this is January to March 2010. That's the edition. And it's about God making us male and female. And this letter writer from Victoria, Australia, points out that evidence of God's design for marriage to be monogamous, we find it in the fact that the birth ratio between males and females is almost balanced, Fred. It turns out that you have 1,000 boys, you have about 1,000 girls.
It's perfectly balanced. So there wasn't Adam and Steve?
There wasn't Adam and Steve. It was Adam and Eve. And in China, where they have been aborting girls, they have an intense sex selection abortion. There's a crisis of men in China unable to find brides. I mean, this is truly a crisis of epidemic proportion. They've slaughtered tens of millions of little girls in China. And every murder of an innocent child, an unborn child, is wicked. But China has this additional problem of now they have men who can't find wives.
And that stems from population control, this myth that the world's overpopulated.
Right.
I remember Jacques Cousteau, a lot of people really like this guy.
She's a squid.
And he said that we should kill 300,000 people a day to deal with the population control. He said, I know that's a horrible thing to say, but somebody has to say it.
Somebody has to say it.
Because he bought into this.
And Prince Philip thought we should want to have epidemics. He said he'd like to be reincarnated as a killer virus. Maybe he wants to be an HIV virus and infect more people with AIDS.
Oh, my goodness.
That's Prince Philip.
Wow.
These are overpopulation lunatics.
Yeah, and you know, Japan, a lot of people say, boy, Japan is small in general compared to nations like ours, and how overpopulated they are. They're actually advertising for people to have kids because it's hurting their economy because their population is starting to shrink.
Yeah.
In Spain,
and it tends
it's
to be
a horrible
racist
problem.
Too. A horrible problem. They're like below the replacement rate.
That's right.
And even now, the UN has recognized, the United Nations has recognized that there's a population crisis in Europe and elsewhere. And it's a bit of racism to say, you know, there are too many Chinese people. There are too many Japanese people. There are way too many blacks in Africa. We need to get birth control over there. We need to sterilize.
That's a great point. I've never thought of it from that angle.
Yeah, there's a good percentage of people who advocate this who are racist.
And there's a lot of people who push, you know, population control. I just tell them, next time you're in an airplane, get a window seat and look out the window and see just how populated our country is when you fly, say, from here to Kansas City. You're going to look a lot of empty space.
Right.
And I think, Bob, I'm not sure if it was you, but somebody gave an example that I really like, that you could fit the entire population of our country in Jacksonville. And everybody
Florida.
Would have something like 5 yards per square foot for each person.
Well, we've pointed out that you take the whole world's population and put them in Rocky Mountain National Park, and yeah, they have to spill over into Estes Park, or the whole world could move to Texas, and we'd have enough room for everyone to live, and we could use the rest of the world for agriculture and for vacationing.
Well, if we do the Estes Park thing, let me know ahead of time because I might buy a restaurant up there or something.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. All right. Now, Fred, another letter to the editor, this from South Carolina. And this guy writes, you know, when I read about the global flood and Noah, then if that's true, you should see dramatic evidence of runoff, of flood drainage. And so he said, I've been using Google Maps and looking at the southwestern part of America, and that's where the Grand Canyon is, Fred. And he points out that if there's a massive global flood, you should see dramatic runoff. Whereas if there are local floods and slow runoff, you'd see different patterns. And he said, so what do you find when you go to Google Maps? You don't find small, narrow debris patterns. You find these enormous, massive debris patterns of over 200 miles wide. And he said, I was so excited. And you see it, and it's exciting. You can see the same thing in northwest China. And the editors of Creation Magazine, they say, keep going, Christopher Carson from South Carolina. Google Maps is a great way to see the effects of the receding floodwaters.
That's right. There's evidence all over the world of a global flood. And it's interesting. Secular scientists will try to tell you there's no evidence of a global flood. And they'll look at something like, you know, Mars, and they'll see patterns of flood, and they'll say there's a global flood on Mars.
Yeah.
But they deny the same evidence here.
It's so funny because here the Earth is covered 2/3 in water, miles deep. On Mars, it's as dry as a desert, and they think there's a global flood on Mars, but not on Earth.
Well, they also thought there was global warming on Mars, and remember, we thought, well, maybe that's, we knew NASA had a bunch of SUVs up there they weren't telling us about.
That's right, but it only turns out there were two SUVs on Mars. All right, so Fred, can we go to the next topic? And it's about Voyager 1, when NASA sent Voyager 1 out into space and it reached the edge of the solar system. This is an editorial by Don Batten, editor of Creation Magazine. He reminds us that Carl Sagan asked NASA to turn Voyager around and take a picture looking back toward Earth. And Fred, the picture is now so well known, this pale blue dot. And Carl Sagan said about it, I mean, what a great idea to do that. And by the way, I think it shows evidence of Noah's flood and the source of comets and all that, but that's another story. But Carl Sagan points out that we are insignificant and we have a imagined self-importance, and he calls it a delusion that somehow we're in a privileged position in the universe. And he says that's all challenged by this point of pale light that we are. And then I want to ask you about Carl Sagan's conclusion then.
Okay.
He says, seeing how insignificant we are, it tells us that we should be kind to one another and take care of the planet.
So he sounds like an earth worshiper.
An earth worshiper.
I think God talked about this in Romans 1.
Yeah, where
he worships the creation instead of the creator.
You deny the creator, so you have to take care of the creation. That's all you've got to commit yourself to.
How I'd respond to that is, scientific evidence is now overwhelming that we are in a special place in the universe. I highly recommend that the listening audience purchase Privileged Planet, and I believe you carry that, right, Bob?
Yeah, we do sell that here at Bob and Yurt Live online at KGOV.com. What a great
It's a great video. It's very well animated. The graphics are fantastic. PBS actually showed this. It was shocking, but they actually showed this video on PBS. And it provides all the evidence that shows that we aren't insignificant. We're in the center of space and at the perfect location to be able to observe what we do.
And aside from that video, which shows that we have a special place in the Milky Way galaxy, Fred, there's also scientific evidence from the redshift of the light from galaxies that it looks like our galaxy and our planet is near the center of the universe.
That's right. They're called quantized redshifts. And basically, if you can imagine yourself looking at a dartboard, and on your dartboard on each concentric circle are galaxies. And as the farther you go out from the dartboard, there's another concentric circle of galaxies. So our galaxy is in the center of all these. You shouldn't observe that.
If
you
fact,
weren't in the center, you right. If you're in the center, that's the only way you can observe that pattern.
Yeah.
And it's evolutionists who have discovered this, and it's
and
quietly,
it contradicts
the Big Bang. It contradicts
sure does. Their Copernican principle, their principle of mediocrity, that there is no center of the universe, there's no edge, we don't have a privileged place. And the evidence is coming in that that's just flat out wrong. There's something else funny about this. Oh, and by the way, why don't they tell students that there's no scientific evidence for that Copernican principle? It's just a belief system. It's an assumption that there's no God, so there was no creation, so mankind should not have a privileged place in the universe, so therefore we believe that mankind does not have a privileged place. That is not based on scientific observation. That's based on their religious philosophical worldview.
That's right. It's a tax-funded religion taught in the public schools.
Whoa.
And they do not have the evidence. We have the evidence on our side, and the evidence is overwhelming.
And, Fred, a final comment about Carl Sagan. When he says that because the Earth is insignificant, Stephen Hawking likes to say the same thing, we're insignificant. So he says that we should take care of one another and take care of the planet. Now, how does it logically follow that if the entire Earth is insignificant, how could a microbe on the Earth be significant? What would it matter how one microbe treats another microbe if the whole planet is insignificant? I mean, it's a complete contradiction to his atheistic worldview to say he's borrowing this from Christianity. Therefore, we should love one another and we should have dominion over the Earth.
It's a complete non sequitur.
Yeah, it really is. Okay, next article is on white blood cells. Fred, this is so interesting. It turns out, of course, when you have an infection, your body, your immune system is just so astounding and complicated, and your body will dispatch white blood cells to go to the location of the infection to fight it. And to eat the germs, basically.
It's an amazing system. It's irreducibly complex, and you can read about it in Michael Behe's Darwin's Black Box.
That's right. What a great book. And so, Fred, it turns out that these white blood cells, and this is according to research at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, the white blood cells behave like millipedes. They sprout tiny legs that are less than a micron long. That's 1/25,000th of an inch. And they move quickly. They attach and detach from the blood vessel walls. They have to stay along the wall because otherwise they'll just tumble in the rapid circulation of the blood vessel. They stay along the blood vessel's wall. And as these legs are moving along, they have sensors in them. And the sensors tell the white blood cell when it's getting to the place of the infection. And then it has to escape the blood vessel, and it starts eating the germs.
What an amazing design, and the information content for this to work. You know, I wish the audience could see the picture to do it justice.
Yeah.
I guess if I was an evolutionist, I'd ask, weren't these legs like vestigial leftovers? Aren't the whales supposed to have legs?
Yeah,
that are...
right. Yeah, in fact, there's an article in here about Darwin was wrong, and this is from evolutionary scientists who say Darwin was wrong about the appendix. The appendix is not a leftover organ from evolution. And so evolutionists, Fred, these are researchers writing in the Journal of Evolutionary Biology. They say this. They conclude their article on the appendix. They say Charles Darwin was wrong. The appendix is a whole lot more than an evolutionary remnant, and they call for the textbooks to correct themselves. I mean, it's been decades that we know that Darwin was wrong on the appendix. Let's stop repeating these evolutionary cliches.
How long has the ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny myth been in our textbooks? And that's that whole thing about how, you know, all the embryos of all the different animals in the world all look the same, and so we must have all came from the same animal.
Right.
And then when you actually look at them, they're totally different.
Right. The scientist who actually was awarded like a knightship, and he started a group called Atheists for Ethics. And it turns out that he forged the drawings of the fetus at different stages. And he said, look, they have gills. They're like reptiles. They're like fish. And he made it up, Fred. And still, even though that has been fully exposed by evolutionists, our textbooks will still mislead students into believing that that stuff is true.
Well, that's right. There's a Harvard professor that has it on his website. He's actually retired now, and I challenged him on it, and he refused to take those pictures off, even though he knew that story.
Yeah,
he knew that they were fraudulent.
So, so they promote fraudulent, these icons of evolution, because they're so committed to them, because they prove evolution, they think, when they don't, and they're fraudulent.
So they promote these ideas about the embryos just like they're promoting the appendix. So why do they need to resort to this kind of evidence?
Because they don't have good evidence. So they say, oh, look, they got a disease. That's proof of evolution. We're like, no, both sides agree that things break down. The question is if they can build up from molecules to man by nature and mutations. And the answer to that is no. So show us evidence. You think that happens? Show us evidence. They don't have evidence, Fred, so they make things up.
Yeah, like this white blood cell. How do they explain that these legs sprout out like they do at microscopic levels? It's amazing.
Yeah, it's just extraordinary. Now, there's a girl, a 10-year-old German girl, who was born with half a brain. And, Fred, she's witty, charming, intelligent. And something happened with her that really shocked scientists. The cliche idea that we humans evolved from chimps or ape ancestors and they had smaller brains, and as our brains got bigger, we got smarter. And that is just, again, another example of such superficiality, such superstition among Darwinists, atheists, evolutionists, professors, as though what? Young Japanese women are not as smart as the front line of the Denver Broncos because they have smaller brains and the Broncos have larger brains. And it's just so immature, and it's so
simplistic, and it's so cartoonish.
It is, and it's the opposite of what we know to be reality. Well, this girl, She's born with half a brain. And Fred, they thought, okay, so she's intelligent, but she should only be able to process half of her field of vision because the left side of your brain processes the images on the right side of your field of vision and vice versa. Turns out that this young girl, she can see her entire field of vision. She has normal vision, and it's because her optic nerves rerouted themselves to go to just her half of her brain, and they're just stunned that this happens and she could see normally.
That's amazing. So that tells me that there is information present that detects this condition. It's like a redundancy. Okay, this part's failing, and the body has the intelligence to recircuit these things. And that's amazing because this is technology that we try to do today of redundancy, because redundancy is huge in the industries that I've worked in.
Computer science and communications.
It's very important for, like, you know, for example, the storage industry. Redundancy is huge for them, and it's very complex to make sure if something fails, you have a plan to switch to a redundant system.
And, so,
and this is even more elaborate because it's actually rerouting all these things.
Yeah. And Fred, how could this evolve? Because first of all, you have a human child who's born with half a brain. The parents lovingly care for this child and work to try to help this child develop normal functions. In the wild, an animal born with half a brain might be dead within 5 days. And how rare is it that a child would be born with half a brain and then live to reproduce long enough so that this ability would be in the entire gene pool of Homo sapiens? I mean, this is evidence that these things don't come about by natural selection. Natural selection would kill off a little child with half a brain.
That's right. Natural selection really is only, it's a conservation mechanism. It serves to basically eliminate lethal mutations from a population.
It's not a creative.
It can't build information.
Right.
Yet evolutionists want you to believe that. They want you to believe that natural selection working with random mistakes in the DNA somehow can create these complex features that we're talking about.
Right, exactly. Fred, there's another article in here, huge volcanic eruptions. Scientists studying the geology in southwest China say that there were eruptions in the past that were so enormous that they dwarf other eruptions we know about, like Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens eruption, now that was big, 1980.
That was huge.
And it helped to disprove a lot of evolutionary assumptions.
It overturned 90% of what we know of geology. I heard that from a geologist.
And because we have a whole system of canyons, including the Engineers Canyon, where there are dozens, hundreds of layers, strata, and it was all carved within hours and days, not millions of years.
Not millions of years.
Wow. And then in Spirit Lake, we have trees that became waterlogged, hundreds of thousands of trees floating. They become waterlogged, and they sink vertically upright, and they embed themselves in the bottom as the debris is still settling, and their root systems are all broken off. Turns out that's the exact pattern of many of the petrified trees, like in Yellowstone. We now know how the Yellowstone petrified trees got there. They sunk from a catastrophe involving a flood.
That's right.
And so much fun.
Yeah, so, you know, at Mount St. Helens, we've got basically a river running down these canyons. There's a river running right down the middle of Engineers Canyon, right?
Yeah.
Or I guess it's not a river. It's like a creek.
Yeah,
but
it's
Bob,
a creek.
I don't know. I've looked at the pictures, and I think that creek carved that out one pebble at a time.
Yeah, right. And in reality, the stream did not carve the canyons. The canyons formed the stream, and that's true. The canyons formed the stream. If it wasn't for the catastrophe that carved out these canyons with mud and ash flows from the volcano, there would be no canyons. There would be no creek. That creek at the bottom of those canyons was formed by the canyons. The canyons were not formed by the creek. And you show a geologist a picture of that and don't tell him where it is, and he'll tell you that creek took millions of years to carve those canyons.
That's right. And unfortunately, in our high school textbooks, they still talk about how the Grand Canyon was carved out by the Colorado River millions of years.
Which is increasingly rejected by even secular geologists.
That's right.
And it was caused by a regional catastrophic flood, a dam breach. Fred, we know some of the big eruptions like Mount Pinatubo, 10 cubic kilometers of volcanic lava. Vesuvius, imagine a kilometer, square kilometer, now a cubic kilometer, 4 cubic kilometers of lava. Vesuvius, Mount St. Helens was 1 cubic kilometer. Well, there's this one volcanic eruption in southwest China, Fred, 500,000 cubic kilometers of lava. 500,000.
Wow.
There is evidence around the world of worldwide geologic catastrophe, which is a consequence of the global flood.
Wow. That's 500,000
cubic kilometers of lava. It's just intense. So, and last story, Fred, it turns out now they've known this for 10 years as far as research goes. Now it's beyond any doubt that researchers have shown that children who do not have religious faith in their culture, children who are not taught about God or a creator, that they believe in a creator, they believe that the universe, that the world is designed and has a purpose, even young children.
God's invisible attributes are clearly seen.
Wow. That's right.
Another quote from Romans 1.
Romans chapter 1. So God has put within us the knowledge that he exists and he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. He has a purpose for our existence and our world. And it turns out that young kids know that there is a purpose for this, and therefore that evolution and the atheists are wrong, that there is no purpose for the universe.
That's amazing.
Isn't that exciting?
Hey, Bob, I want to make a quick announcement. Ed Holroyd will be our speaker tonight at Bethlehem Lutheran Church, 7 p.m.
And Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
Yes, and that's Wadsworth and roughly 20th
okay.
Street.
All right, and that's going to be exciting. And also, tomorrow is the St. Paddy's Day Parade. Please come on out. In Denver, you can meet my team. We're going to meet right at Coors Field at Blake and 21st Street. Blake and 21st, right at the main entrance of Coors Field. So, Fred Williams, thanks for joining me. It's really been great to have you on.
Oh, this is great, Bob. Thanks for all these hard questions.
All right, another episode of Real Science Friday. What a fun program. And we now have CDs. We have Real Science Friday 2007, 2008, and 2009. You can get it all on a CD. Give it to a friend. Have a great time. And Maranatha, what a wonderful school. And our website is kgov.com. There is a home listed for sale in Arvada, Colorado that you must see to appreciate. This home boasts of approximately 3,500 square feet on 2.3 secluded acres, zoned agricultural with waterfalls and water rights. With that much land, you could bring the family, bring the horses and or the livestock. It's listed at $499,000, $35,000 under the current appraised value. For more information or to schedule a showing, please call Sharon Bean, Dynamic Properties of Colorado, 303-358-9859. That's 303-358-9859.